Ontario Premier Doug Ford has been foreshadowing a major announcement tomorrow, which is expected to include a huge investment by Honda into new facilities to build batteries for and assemble new electric vehicles. Flavio Volpe is president of the Automotive Parts Manufacturers Association of Canada. Flavio, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on tonight. And certainly you were not talking about the Toronto Maple Leafs. I'll bring the opinion from Toronto here. They're not going to end that streak for anybody.
Now, were you watching the game? On the game, for those tuning in, if they weren't watching, that game just ended, and what, Boston got an empty netter and now 2-1 in the series?
Yeah, 2-1 in the series. We blew a couple of leads, but that's what we do out here. We make cars and we blow leads. So
we make cars and we blow leads. Those are the two things to be known for in Southern Ontario. Yeah. Well, you never know. They lost the first game. They came back to tie it up. Maybe they can win the next one. Who knows, right?
Let's see. Go Canucks.
Yeah, you got to move on to the next Canadian team, I guess. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now, I did want to pick your brain a little bit about this, announcement that we're expecting about Honda and about building batteries and assembling vehicles in Southern Ontario. Just how significant are we expecting this announcement to be and this investment to be?
So what we're anticipating tomorrow is an announcement by Honda, which is one of the world's five biggest automakers, that they're going to make an investment that is bigger. This is from the company's investment, twice as big as the Volkswagen investment, which when it was announced last year was the biggest one in Canadian history. It's probably bigger than any other investment that any other car maker has made in North America. The previous biggest one was a Ford Motor Company making an investment in cars and batteries in Tennessee and Kentucky 2 years ago.
And so if you could speculate on this, why is this investment and are these dollars in this industry now coming to Canada? I know there were some investments in the most recent budget that were announced, but on the surface of it, sometimes we're hearing that Canada is not a place where companies are looking to park their money and make these sorts of investments.
Well, look, I can only speak for the automotive business. Certainly, there's a lot of argument on whether Canada's competitor or not overall for foreign investment. But in the car business, when we renegotiated the new NAFTA rules, the new rules bonused jurisdictions that had the components to manufacture batteries, whether that's the minerals or the batteries themselves, as well as EV components. We wrote them into the new rules because we knew, especially in Quebec and Ontario, but to some degree in Alberta and BC as well, we have the minerals required to make these batteries. And the way you build cars is the biggest, chunkiest components are centered around the plant. These batteries are 900 pounds. That usually takes tens of thousands of pounds of rocks to be processed into these batteries. And so we knew that they would anchor a lot of the EV conversation. And the federal and provincial governments have been out hustling really hard with automakers who are already here to see if they can't electrify here. And Honda has been here since 1986, the first Japanese automaker to invest in Canada. And so it was four decades of experience. The biggest single commercial employment site in Canada is Honda's current campus, making Honda Civics and HRVs just north of Toronto. So it was a conversation, a pursuit of investment with someone, with a company that's been a partner for four decades. It wasn't like Volkswagen, which was new conversations, or any of the other companies that we'd go out and chase.
And so in your mind, then, is it significant that it is Honda? I mean, it'd be great if it was anybody, but is that a signal? Is that a sign? Is that a positive that it's actually Honda that's we're expecting to make this investment and this announcement tomorrow?
Look, I represent hundreds of suppliers, companies that make the components that go into the original assembly. Honda has one of the best reputations, I would say, Honda and Toyota, in how they deal with Canadian suppliers. Predictability, they pay their bills on time. It's a really bankable contract. They also are the world leader in emissions on internal combustion. And what I've always said to people is, look, we're not going to get to 100% electrification, especially by 2035, but we'll get there at some point. But it'll be these legacy car companies that know how to make efficient vehicles are going to be the ones that are going to lead us in hybridization and then electrification. And so Honda's reputation, you know, look, I've got several Hondas. I've got the one that cuts the grass in my backyard, and I got the generator, and then we have a car, and then you have your outboard motor. A versatile powertrain company is one that I trust to get across the line quicker than a lot of these EV startups that start with a bang, and then you know, the market catches up to them and they get into trouble.
Yeah, well, when you put it that way about how diverse Honda is, I'm just thinking about it as you were talking. I've got a generator and a quad that is made by Honda, and both very reliable, seem to run forever with very, very few problems. You did mention the components, the minerals that are needed to go into these batteries, which would presumably come from mines in northern Ontario. Do you have any sense of where we are and how long it might take to get those, to extract those minerals and be ready to start building batteries?
Well, look, if we're honest, that's still all very gray. We know that the mines exist, and their geological studies are proving that the volumes are there. Agencies like Bloomberg, NEF, Rate Canada, as the number one country for EV battery supply chain, ahead of China. Now, in the business, you know, if you're making cars and parts and you're buying these components, we're not number one. China's number one because you can actually buy lithium and cells from China right now. In Canada, we're still at in many cases, the beginning stages of the approval processes that can't be skipped, that are, you know, 8 to 15 years out. And so there are companies like Sayona Mining in Quebec that are delivering rocks that are, you know, that you can buy your lithium from them. There are sources of nickel, cobalt, graphite. There are companies like Frontier Lithium who announced just a few weeks ago that they've got a deal with Panasonic and Mitsubishi. But we're still early, and we need a concerted national effort to get those approvals in place in time that car companies will buy them. You know, the Chinese aren't sitting around saying, oh, we'll wait till Canada's ready. We'll sell you the stuff on a one-year basis. Chinese are saying, oh, you want it? We'll give you a cut rates, but we're going to sign you up for 10 years. So even when some of the Canadian stuff is ready, it's going to be a tough go of it. We also know of some very important advances in different sources of lithium that I think would be very interesting. You know, there's a few companies out there extracting lithium from brine water, from oil and gas extraction. It'd be really, really interesting to be able to see if that could be a source at scale so that it isn't just Ontario and Quebec who's in play here, but also some of the provinces that have core competencies in resource extraction.
You know, it's interesting. We seem sometimes to get competing stories on where exactly we are in Canada when it comes to the move toward electric vehicles. There are a couple of recent surveys that said Canadians' interest in purchasing electric vehicles has begun to wane. And yet, there's also some hard sales figures that would indicate that actual sales of electric vehicles increased as much as 300% last year. So we'll talk about that. We'll be joined in our next segment by the Canadian Automotive Dealers Association. Try and get a handle just on where we are and how we're feeling about this move to electric vehicles. Right now, though, we're discussing the anticipated announcement tomorrow with Ontario Premier Doug Ford, and Honda expected to announce a major investment by Honda into building facilities to build batteries and to assemble electric vehicles in the province of Ontario. And once again, our guest is Flavio Volpe, the president of the Automotive Parts Manufacturers Association of Canada. Of course, once these plants are built, it's probably going to take a lot of people to staff them. How are we looking right now when it comes to that sector of the economy?
Well, certainly, we know exactly how many people these plants need and when they need them, and then how many in the supply sector. We do have a labor shortage generally in manufacturing here in central Canada. But you know, Canadians have shown a willingness to move for jobs like this in similar ways that many from the east have moved west for jobs in the oil and gas sector. It's a challenge, but what we've seen over the and what these companies are seeing over the past two decades, especially in the clusters that manufacture cars. So there's the Midwestern one that includes Ontario and Quebec, I would say. Then there's the U.S. Southeast cluster that makes about 75% of the cars that we make every year. And then there's a big cluster in Mexico. The turnover rates are twice as high in those other areas than they are in places like Ontario. And the service time for a typical worker is usually they stay 10 to 12 years in a company in Ontario, and they stay 5 to 6 in the Southeast. So in a relative sense, these companies know they need to make these products. They need to recruit and train staff. It's tough all over North America, but it's less tough in places like Ontario. And then we've got five major universities that have dedicated automotive programs, and then 12 colleges that are trades colleges with that are training the types of skills that are required to run manufacturing operations. It's not easy, but we're well positioned.
Do we have a sense yet? And I don't know if we still consider electric vehicles a new industry, an emerging industry, but do we have a sense, you know, does it take more or fewer people to manufacture and assemble an electric vehicle versus an internal combustion vehicle?
Look, at the assembly plant, it's the same number of people. The assembly lines are very, very similar. In terms of components, look, there's less people making engine and transmission parts. You know, the motors and the e-gears that go to the electric vehicles are much more simple. But that's offset by the multiples of people putting together batteries, cells, modules, power electronics, trays and related components versus the amount of jobs that are in gas tanks and fuel delivery systems. It's very, very similar overall. The difference really is an electric vehicle with a 100 kilowatt battery is a 400 or 800 volt platform. Means you're going to have to, especially if you're assembling the powertrains or if you're servicing the vehicles, you're going to have high voltage training. And high voltage safety is very important. And so some of these jobs will change. And of course, the same type of innovation that's going into the vehicles themselves is going into the factories. And so we have smarter factories, some autonomous delivery systems in there, really integrated, Internet of Things in there too. And so the factory jobs, the running and managing and the optimizing of productivity, there's more of those jobs and they require a higher skill set. Electric cars aren't new. I think we all, a lot of us played with electric remote control cars when we were kids. And
true enough.
And, I went to Mazda in 2018 to meet their battery partner. And in their lobby, they had a Detroit electric car from 1910. And then it was a Detroit-based electric car company that was the New York City cab company, and then it was a Japanese battery. So, you know, they've been around a long time.
Flavio, interesting conversation. We thank you for your time tonight. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Appreciate it.
Right now, we're going to continue our discussion along the lines of electric vehicles. Of course, the announcement anticipated tomorrow in Ontario that Honda is about to make a huge multi-billion-dollar investment for new facilities to build batteries and to assemble electric vehicles. We're joined now by Hugh Williams. He's with the Canadian Automotive Dealers Association. Hugh, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
First of all, any reaction from you? I know you're kind of on the dealer side of this when it comes to cars and vehicles in this country, but it seems like pretty positive news for Honda to be investing this kind of dough in Canada.
Yeah, I would say for about 25 years now, all of, regardless of party, regardless of government, there's been a real recognition that Canada had a very strong automotive manufacturing base and that drives the economy. Back in the 1990s, it was one in every seven jobs and they were dependent on the auto industry. And it became a more competitive market as the U.S. really fought for investment. Some of the southern states were really pushing to expand the worldwide footprint for the American market. And as a result, with the Harper government and the Trudeau government, it didn't really matter who, have had a direction of trying to encourage investment in the country, because these factory footprints are enormous and they drive not just the whole automotive supply chain in the country, from the parts to the actual assembly, but they also are good for the retail distribution side of the equation. So it's a competitive marketplace, and Canada is increasingly becoming seen as a place to invest in the auto sector, which is a good thing for the Canadian economy.
And the minerals are here as well. We did touch on that in our previous segment, and I know that can be a bit of a touchstone for some people as well, because there's a whole debate about, what kind of mining activity will be required ultimately to power all of these batteries. But I wanted to talk to you, Hugh, if we can, just about the sense of where we are in Canada, how we're feeling about electric vehicles. I was interested, just within the last short while, there were some surveys. I think one was done by Auto Trader, but it seemed to indicate that, when they're surveying people, that our interest in purchasing electric vehicles may be waning a little bit already. And then yet some figures come out, some hard sales figures that say, sales of electric vehicles increased by as much as 300% in the last year. So where are we?
Yeah, I mean, electric vehicle sales are nudging up in this country and taking a larger and larger portion of overall sales. We touched near 11% last year in overall sales, but it's a really kind of the tale of two cities, or the tale of rural versus urban. Electric vehicles in British Columbia, in an urban center, make an incredible amount of sense, and there's a lot of really positive consumer response to the technology, the feel of the vehicles, the pleasure of not having to go to a gas station. And as you start to get better and better technology across more and more makes, the consumer experience is fantastic. It's different, though, as you move outside of urban centers. And if you think of places like northern Saskatchewan, which gets bitter cold winters, the population is more spread out, the charging infrastructure is more of a challenge. Electric vehicles don't make sense in that context. You have a province like Nova Scotia that manufactures electricity using coal-fired electric power. So the common sense equation that as you plug in your car, you're really using coal power to charge it. Again, there's a different equation in that part of the country. What we've said all along is that electric vehicles are part of the equation. They're going to be great for some customers, and there may be a transition that takes place to EV technology, other technologies, but we can't have a mandatory kind of Soviet style dictate that the entire country of Canada is going to be driving electric vehicles, especially when we don't have the charging infrastructure to make that happen. Because if Canadians can't charge their cars where they work, live, and play, the whole experiment is going to move backwards, and those mandates are actually going to make it more difficult for us to make a transition to the right technology.
Yeah, it does seem any transition is not going to be, it's not going to be quick, and it won't necessarily be smooth. And, one of the counters to the notion that, if you live in a cold climate, if you're living northern Saskatchewan, we use the example that you use, that they're not as effective, the range decreases in some cases quite dramatically. The pushback on that has always seemed to be, okay, but that may be the case now, but by the time we get to 2035 and beyond, we'll have solved that issue. And we talk about the infrastructure and the lack of charging stations. Well, that's okay, but by the time we get there, we'll have addressed that. But for a lot of people, if you're going out to buy a vehicle today, I'm not You don't always get the sense that trust us and it'll be better 10 years from now is working.
Yeah, I think what you're looking at is, you know, consumers are smart and they're educated and they have more access to information than ever before. And what you're seeing is that, you know, the early adopters who liked the technology jumped into the marketplace, wanted to give it a try. They wanted to try it for a whole host of reasons, better performance, no gas, all of those kind of things. But then others for environmental reasons. The challenge, of course, is when you try to go swing to an extreme and ensure that that's the only technology that you choose. If you look at the U.S. situation, and the Biden administration is not known for being radically pro industry. They've come out with a greenhouse gas based fuel economy standard, which basically means that they are dictating that the auto industry has to produce green cars that bring overall greenhouse gas reductions to the fleet, and it's agnostic into how they do that. Do you build smaller cars? Do you build more efficient cars? Do you build more electric cars? Is there another technology that's out there? Whereas here in Canada, the federal government has made a decision to really just bet all in on one technology, which is EVs. Having said that, EVs are going to be an important part of the future. It's just when you start to look at, will it be 100% of that future, and will it keep pace with the charging infrastructure, the grid? That's where we get into problems. And just one kind of an example for your listeners is that if you think of a family today that's buying an EV, typically what we've seen at the dealership level is people are buying it as their second car, and they're kind of keeping that option open to have, a vehicle for longer range, perhaps one that might be used in a more traditional sense. And the electric vehicle is more used for the easy commute type situation. And oftentimes that, those can be, if people in a household can decide to switch based on what their pattern is. But as we start to bump up against, the 100% adoption, that's where you're seeing, I would argue worldwide, lots of markets pulling back and going, okay, is this the right thing? And can our infrastructure even handle it? I mean, we had California this summer, it's a well-known case that was encouraging people not to plug in their cars because the grid couldn't handle it because of the air conditioning needs and other challenges. So, Canada, we have the opposite problem, and people will freeze to death if we have problems with the grid and people are all driving electric cars and run out of power.
My guest is Hugh Williams of the Canadian Automotive Dealers Association, talking about electric vehicles and where are we in this country in terms of our desire to purchase these and drive them. And as Hugh was mentioning before the break, a lot of that may depend on your lifestyle. Can you afford two vehicles? Are you a two-vehicle family where one of these vehicles could be used for commuting around town or around the city, really not going on long road trips? And maybe the other car is used in that more traditional sense where you might be going, this is Canada after all, on an hours-long road trip just for a long weekend in the summer, and you're looking for that range. Weather could be a factor that plays into whether you want to drive or think you will be able to drive a fully electric vehicle if you're in a northern part of the country where it gets to minus 20, minus 30. This year we saw parts of the country where it was minus 45 for extended periods of time. So those are all factors, I guess, that people will need to take into consideration. I'm wondering, Hugh, we did talk before about some of these surveys, and you get mixed results sometimes where some surveys say that people are starting to their interest in purchasing electric vehicles is beginning to wane already. Other surveys and some sales statistics that say the sales continue to rise, in some cases dramatically, other ways times at just sort of a more modest pace. Does it make it difficult for dealers when they're looking at their inventory and what they're going to need? And I'm not even sure how far out in advance they order the inventory, but how do you manage this when there seem to be more unknowns out there than there have been in the past?
Yeah, I think the good news for the average consumer is that all of the manufacturers are competing to bring the best technology to the marketplace and the most consumer-friendly technology to the marketplace. So you have, basic battery technology, you have hybrid technology, you've got plug-in hybrids. I mean, there's a real element, and there's a technology race going on behind the scenes as well to make the range better, to make the charging infrastructure more efficient. And the other piece of really good news for consumers who are considering an EV is, you know, the most important measure of whether these cars work is that the vast majority of those that purchase an EV, you know, would never consider going back. Once they find that it fits their lifestyle and they're comfortable with it, they stick with it. And, you know, that says, I think, a lot for the technology. So the challenge isn't kind of gradual adoption and you know, companies and customers finding the right path for them. It's the path that we've been put on by, you know, I would argue, alarmist politics that hasn't really considered charging infrastructure, hasn't considered the affordability equation, the rural nature of Canada, and it's put us on a path where, you know, we've got to have 20% sales by 2026, a mandate for 60% sales by 2030, and 100% by 2035, which is, you know, really right around the corner when you consider how model years work in the auto industry. So I think there's just a sense that the transition is happening, but a forced transition will actually drive things in reverse, as, you know, consumers won't be able to afford those cars. There'll be fewer cars sold, and consumers who are aware are going to hold on to their older cars. That's what I'm worried about, is that as we try to force this transition, it'll actually send things in reverse gear for a transition to a greener future.
Well, I could certainly see situations where if people were, you know, right now thinking, well, maybe it's time for a new vehicle, but because it's uncertain, we're not quite sure where it's going. We're not quite sure what the advancements in electric vehicles or hybrids might be in the next couple of years. We're not sure where the infrastructure is going to be. So maybe we just hold off and you know, we play that wait and see game, which is not good for selling vehicles and keeping that industry going. What sort of answers are you getting right now in your industry when you ask about things like infrastructure? When are we going to see? And we do see more charging stations, but we're talking tens of thousands that we need to get up and rolling here.
Yeah, we have a website called the roadto2035.ca. So the roadto2035.ca, which actually has a tracker and all the milestones that are required for the charging infrastructure to make this transition happen. And the bad news side of the equation is we're nowhere near where we need to be on charging infrastructure to match the government's objective. The charging infrastructure is growing. It's improving. So for incremental growth, as people transition to EVs, if you're in a showroom tomorrow and you're thinking of an EV, you're going to be able to charge your car. You want to talk to the dealer about and look at your own circumstances. Can I put in a charger in my home? How will that situation work? You know, you have to make those individual decisions. The problem doesn't become as we go to 11, 15, you know, 16, or an inch or way up in terms of sales, which is a really good news story and quite remarkable. The problem becomes when you try to force that into 100% too soon and the charging infrastructure is not there. Then the customer experience goes way down. People will hold on to older technology, higher polluting cars, and you don't help the environment. And only, you know, quite frankly, wealthy people under this scenario are going to be able to afford to have a car. And that's not the Canadian way. You know, the Canadian way is innovation, customers making the right choice for their family is that better choice of technology. And that's really a better answer. And, quite frankly, if the government's going to mandate the sale of electric vehicles, they have to do a way, way better job of charging infrastructure. I mean, I look at Natural Resources Canada, the building here in Ottawa, which is in charge of pushing out the infrastructure. They have a whole big parking lot, and they've got two chargers in their own parking lot in their own department. So, it's not a very realistic situation, and we've got to bring some reality to it because that'll help customers make the right decision as they go forward. Because EVs are great technology. If you've got your charging figured out, people don't want to switch back. And that's what we have to rely on to move things forward, not on kind of mandates that haven't worked on other things across the years.
You're right. Your experience is probably the same as mine. Mine's just anecdotal with people that, you know, in my sort of sphere of friends and family, I don't know of anyone that has purchased a fully electric vehicle. There's a lot of planning that goes into it. Like you say, you have to kind of think about your lifestyle, where you're heading, what your needs are. But I don't know of anyone that has purchased a fully electric vehicle that doesn't love it and say that they will never go back. So you're right. Once people get into it, if they've made that decision and it works for them, they do seem to love these vehicles, but there's a lot of work to be done. People that work in, or excuse me, live in apartment buildings and condos, and there's so many things that have to be taken into account here before we can get to the ultimate goal.
Yeah, and if you look at, you know, the downtown Toronto, or you know, any other major city in the country, you know, building codes have not been changed to make it so that new builds have EV charging infrastructure, and there's no plan whatsoever to handle it in reverse. And you know, we need, you know, solutions for mobility across the board. I mean, walking, biking, transit, working vehicle, personal vehicle fleet. All of these things are integrated and make some sense. But where we're going to go astray is when we try to force something from almost a I don't want to say religious point of view, but almost a zealot point of view, to say we have to hit these numbers. Or otherwise there's going to be penalties. The manufacturers will just sell fewer vehicles so that their ratios are right. And by having fewer vehicles, the price is going to go up for consumers, and the people that are going to be hurt are people in rural communities, remote communities, and people whose incomes aren't in the upper quadrant. So, you know, we've really got to do this right. And I think the transition we're seeing now is exciting, as you say. EVs are great products. You know, if you have an ordinary commute and it's fairly regular, people rave about it. And you know, I'm an example of that. It's a very short commute. It's a perfect technology. So, it's about enabling Canadians to make the right choices and giving them affordability and the charging infrastructure they can count on.
Hugh, thanks for your time. Appreciate it tonight.
Appreciate you having me on. Have a good night.
Dillon shoots, deflected in front. Aya follows there. A rebound. They score! David Gustafson with his first ever Stanley Cup playoff goal. And Winnipeg opens up the scoring. 3:15 into this baby. And it's 1-0 for the Jets. Here comes Velarde. Right down Main Street. Back door on the far side. They score! Mark Scheifele got one hand on it, redirected that Velarde pass to the front of the net, put it to the top of the goal, and it's 2-1 Winnipeg.
Well, if you are a Winnipeg Jets fan, what a start to their last game. Unfortunately, that 2-1 lead, that would be the last that the Jets would lead in the game. Colorado came back to win that game. Series is tied at 1. And we are joined to talk a little playoff hockey by Paul Edmonds, the play-by-play voice of the Winnipeg Jets. Paul, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. I'm just walking out of Coors Field in Denver here, where I saw San Diego beat the hometown Rockies. So we got a little ways from hockey tonight and lots of baseball.
Well, maybe that's a good omen that the home team lost in baseball tonight. Maybe the home team loses in hockey tomorrow night.
Yeah, I know. You never know. I mean, I think, to be honest with you, both teams kind of expected it would be a tough, grinded out series, and nobody was going to sweep anybody. So from that standpoint, you know, Winnipeg loses game two, but now they go down to Denver here and see what they can do for game three and four, and try to wrestle home ice advantage back away from the Avalanche, who are a really good team and only a couple years removed from the Stanley Cup. So, you know what, I think it's going to be a real good series as it goes along, and I think it'll probably get to 6 or 7 games.
Yeah, and you know, the Jets have had a great year. They were able to get a couple of their big star players re-signed in the offseason to extensions. Maybe not, I don't know how you would think, maybe not the star power of a MacKinnon and a Makar, but these are two really good teams. They can skate, they can score, and the Jets have great goaltending, although 11 goals have been given up in the first two games.
Yeah, no, you make good points. I mean, you don't have sort of what I call the M&M boys and Makar and MacKinnon, and even Josh Manson, who scored a big goal last night for his team and was a +3 overall. But you still have Scheifele, and you still have Connor, and you still have Connor Hellebuyck. And, you know, from that standpoint, I think Winnipeg matches up when it comes to some talented, highly skilled players. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that there is a winning pedigree with the Colorado Avalanche because they won a Stanley Cup in 2002. So from that standpoint, I mean, you know, they are not that far removed from being the champions. And there was just a look in in Nathan McKinnon's eye yesterday in the pregame skate, and then with the availability that he did. Not very happy with game one and the result for sure. And I thought Nathan was very good last night, and he's very hard to contain with the speed that he has. But it's a good matchup for both teams because Winnipeg kind of plays the speed game like Colorado, but they're different because they can grind it out. And certainly they will try to be a little bit more physical than Colorado. Now, there were times in yesterday's game, in game two, where it got, you know, back and forth and became somewhat of a river hockey game, and that's not the style that Winnipeg wants to play. But it is, in fact, the way that Colorado wants to play. So it's a little bit different. I think that that's the interesting part about this series is you're going to see some tightness to elements of games, but you're also going to see where the game opens up, and we certainly saw that last night.
Yeah, what has Rick Bowness meant to this team? And I know he was away from the team for a while. He seems to be, well, doesn't seem to be, you know, if you look around the league, he's one of the most popular people in the game. What has he meant to this team this year?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think that Rick has brought here in now his second year as the head coach of the Winnipeg Jets, and I mean, he's been over 800 games as a head coach, but 2,700 games as a coach in the National Hockey League, including being an assistant and an associate coach. One of the things that he, I think, really excels at, even though he's one of the older coaches at 69 years old, is his ability to still understand the game and the way it's evolved, but also communicate with the younger players. And that's been really on his side all the way through his career. And so anything that he wants, they draw it up, the X's and O's, he's going to explain to each player why we're doing this. And he's also real hands-on. You know, sometimes I think that comes from being the assistant coach where you're kind of the go-between between the head coach and the players. Well, he's not necessarily that, but he still has an element of that to the way he presents himself and the way he has relationships with his players. So he means a lot, to be frank. The players really enjoy playing for him. They like the scheme and the system that he's implemented. And so from that standpoint, when you have a guy that wants to communicate, a guy that is professional, a guy that lays it out on what he wants you to do, I don't know that you could really ask for a better boss.
Now, before we talk about what we might expect here for the next couple of games in Denver, the atmosphere in the building in Winnipeg has gotten some attention really right across North America. It's been a fantastic showing on television for those who've been able to catch the games on TV. What's it been like broadcasting in that arena in these playoffs?
Yeah, well, it's been electric. I mean, I grew up in the west side of Winnipeg. I was fortunate enough to kind of move away with my career and get a different perspective, and then was able to come home and work for the hometown team. So, you know, I remember the whiteout in its, you know, infancy stages back in 1987, where an ad agency wanted to do kind of something special and a radio station got involved, and it kind of is the rest is history, as they say, story. But it's been electric. I mean, it's been loud. I asked Rick Bowness the question leading up to the game yesterday about game one on Sunday. And at points, he was saying that he was having to literally yell on the bench on who was next up to go over the boards. And then I asked him, I said, well, in saying that, is it hard to sometimes hear the whistles for, say, an offside or an icing call or whether there's going to be a penalty? And he agreed that it's difficult to hear the whistle from the officials on the ice and the chanting. And it's just been a great atmosphere. You know, it's been great for the city, great for the province, great for the organization. They've been doing it for a long time. They've had 15,000-plus people in the building. They've also had 5,000 people just on the east side of the building, and what they call the whiteout party. And then there's been another 1,200 on another side of the building. So, I mean, you've had well over 21,000 people downtown for two nights this year. And anybody knows that does anything, you know, from the social standpoint, downtown is where everybody needs to be, and that's how a city kind of grows from out. And if the core is good and it's healthy, then the city is usually good and healthy, and it's been great for downtown Winnipeg for sure. And I think that they're looking forward to game five, regardless of what happens here in Denver for the next 2 days or the next couple of games. There will be a game five because the series is tied at one. So Winnipeggers are kind of licking their chops at getting another opportunity to have the whiteout back at home.
And that must be kind of heartening, what we've seen in the playoffs from people in Winnipeg, given some of the stories that were not all that positive through the course of the year when it came to fan support.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it was a bit of a byproduct of a latent sort of COVID reaction. This, you know, the decrease in season tickets was not just a drop off the cliff. It was incremental. And it only got to an urgency stage where they kind of looked and said, oh boy, we're probably in a situation where we've got to have an uptick on this. There was 11,000 people in the building for a couple of games early on in the year. And then it got to kind of 13 and kind of hovered around there. After Christmas, it's been very, very good. And in fact, overall, they had 10 sellouts. And most of those were toward the last month, month and a half of the season. So the crowds have come back. Now, the key part is to capitalize on the emotion of the fans right now and get people to kind of spend their money to get back in buying a corporate season ticket or a personal season ticket so that you get back to that 13,000 season tickets that they require to just make sure that everything functions in the smallest market in the National Hockey League financially well. So, you know, I think they're on the right track. A deep playoff run will undoubtedly help that, but that remains to be seen. But as the organization has acknowledged, they've had some work to do, and I think they're on the right track.
And the players, of course, always like to use that energy from the home fans to their advantage. And we saw that maybe most displayed in the early stages of Game 1 in Winnipeg. Now, what are you expecting as the puck drops tomorrow night in Denver and we play two games in Colorado here? What are you expecting from the Jets and from these two teams?
Well, I think that you're going to see probably as loud a building as we've seen in Winnipeg, because Avalanche fans had never really been exposed, certainly on TV or on radio, to what the whiteout was. And, you know, you almost want to kind of trump what's going on in the other city. So I think it's going to be electric in this building. It's a great hockey market here in Denver for the Colorado Avalanche. They have been for decades, and they've won a number of cups. So they're hardened, educated fans here. In terms of the game and the style of game, Winnipeg wants to protect the puck a lot more. They've kind of had some self-inflicted wounds. They've made some mistakes that have cost them some goals. They just haven't been very clean overall in the way they've had their game play. So I think they want to be more efficient in moving the puck and protecting the puck. They're going to need a few saves from what is probably going to be a Vezina-winning goaltender in Connor Hellebuck. And frankly, their specialty teams have to be better, particularly the power play that has one goal so far in the two games. On the Avalanche side, I think what you want to get to is exactly what you were doing in the two games and especially last night, and that's pressure the Winnipeg Jets inside their own zone and attack them with speed. And so that would be the game plan I think that Jared Bednar is trying to roll out with his team and make sure that the pressure game continues and the speed game, which I think that not many can match what Colorado has. That's going to be what they want to do. Winnipeg just wants to play a little bit tighter and a little cleaner with the puck for sure.
Paul, have you been walking this whole time, or are you stationary as you talk to us? Because we know that you just left the Coors Stadium where the Rockies were playing tonight.
Yeah, no, I walked down the stairs and out. I'm on street level, and I'm just kind of stationary here watching some police officers kind of move traffic, both the pedestrian and vehicles.
Okay. Well, we'll let you get to your evening. Get some rest. Great call tomorrow. We look forward to the game.
Yeah. Hey, anytime. Thanks a lot for having me on. I appreciate it.
We're talking a little hockey here on A Little More Conversation this evening. We are into round one of the Stanley Cup playoffs. We only have four Canadian teams that are competing this year. And, you know, all of them are pretty good teams, I would think. I mean, I'm no expert, but it would seem that these aren't teams that, you know, we're talking Toronto and Winnipeg and Edmonton and Vancouver. These aren't teams that just kind of backed into the playoffs. You know, with Winnipeg and Vancouver, maybe there were some experts at the start of the season that didn't rate them as high as they turned out to be. But they've been there from the start of the season. It's not like they just won, you know, they were, you know, so-so all year and, you know, won 10 games to finish the season and found themselves in the playoffs. These are good, legitimate teams that have a chance to win the Stanley Cup. And coming up in a few minutes, we're going to talk to Dan Barnes. He's a feature sports writer with Post Media. And he went and looked at the mathematical probabilities that we could go this long in this country with this many teams and not win the Stanley Cup. I mean, it's not lottery winning odds, but they're very long odds. Like, it would almost be easier for a couple of Stanley Cup wins to happen in the last 31 years than to go 31 straight years with no Stanley Cups. Harder to not win cups than it is to win cups. If you just look at the mathematical probabilities, we'll get into that a little bit later. But first, and you know, this, you know, math plays into this as well, because you have to do your home budget and you have to figure out what you can afford. But we thought it was interesting when there was a survey done on the cheapest and the most expensive round one playoff tickets in these Canadian markets. And here to talk about it with us is Moshe Lander. Moshe is a senior lecturer economics at Concordia University in Edmonton, Alberta. Moshe, thanks for coming on the program tonight.
No, in Montreal. There's a different Concordia.
I'm sorry. There's more than one. I'm sorry. I thought I saw an Alberta a phone number there. So my apologies, Concordia in Montreal, even more sophisticated.
but don't confuse me as a fan of either the Habs or the Oilers. So.
Okay. We will not do that. So let's talk about some of these prices for tickets. I'm going to start in Toronto because they're the most expensive, and I don't think that would come as a surprise to anybody. So, and these, I think, they just went online because people can resell tickets, usually right through, I think Ticketmaster handles the tickets, but you can resell them through the club websites. And we went with pairs of tickets rather than singles because although there are people that just buy one ticket, I think the majority would buy them in at least pairs. So the cheapest pair of tickets in Toronto for round one was $640. And I'm assuming that would be up in, I don't know if we call them nosebleeds anymore in these new arenas because there are still some decent sight lines. The most expensive pair of tickets, $2,700. $100. That's one game, Moshe.
And those are just the ones that are for sale, right? So if there's a bunch of tickets that are currently unavailable, you can imagine that they might even be more expensive. So regardless, they are, yes, very pricey. And given that the Leafs lost tonight, there might only be one more game that you get a chance to enjoy them. So, you know.
We'll go through these quickly. Vancouver, cheapest pair, $600. Most expensive, $2,400. Edmonton, the cheapest pair, $460. Most expensive, $1,800. Winnipeg, the cheapest, $430. The most expensive, $1,400. And I take it this is just simply a case of supply and demand. If people are willing to pay these tickets and you have them, as say you're a season ticket holder and maybe you want to go to a couple of playoff games and then you want to offset your cost by selling them, you're just going to put them up there and if people are willing to pay, you're just going to try and get as much as you can.
Yeah, and there's also the speculative aspect too, that there might not even be season ticket holders. They just get their hands on tickets and you know, when they go on sale, the Oilers knew that they were going to be in the playoffs. So those tickets didn't wait until, you know, the very last minute. So maybe what you do is you just speculate, get your hands on them. And then when you realize they're playing the Kings, hey, this should be something that the Oilers can win, might be exciting for fans. And so you put the tickets up and hope you could make a little profit there, and maybe hide it from CRA or something.
And I do know people that have done this, that have put their tickets on sale. And in previous playoff series in different cities, and what I was told is you almost have to sometimes predict how the team is going to do. So, for example, if you were in Winnipeg and you had tickets for game five that you wanted to sell and they're going to Colorado and they're tied at one, I hope I'm making sense here. So if your pair of tickets right now, you've got them listed at $1,000 and you think that's a legitimate price and you've seen other tickets around you sell for that, but now they're playing tomorrow, and if they get blown out, maybe your tickets aren't worth $1,000 anymore. So there's a timing aspect to this as well.
Very much so. And I'm a former season ticket holder with the Buffalo Sabres, and I mean, they haven't been in the playoffs for back the day when they used to make the playoffs.
They got Lindy Ruff now.
That's right. Good. They used to sell the tickets as home game one, home game two, home game three. So when the tickets would go on sale, you wouldn't sometimes even know if home game one is game one or if it would be game three, right? If you're really close to that second or third spot in the division, home game one could be one or three. And so, you know, it adds to the confusion as well, because for someone like me who grew up in London, Ontario, you know, I'd have to figure out how I'm going to drive 2.5 hours each way in spring rain to figure out, you know, which day am I going and which class am I going to miss? And it can really be an exercise in speculation. So I guess it's probably no different than playing the stock market or Bitcoin in some cases, probably with the same sort of profitability too.
And the other thing I wonder, because I really don't follow, you know, the resale market for playoff hockey tickets, or haven't, maybe now that we're doing this, I'll keep an eye on it this year. But are we selling to the masses, or are there a select few that can afford to purchase these tickets? And because I guess what I'm wondering is, would you anticipate that the prices will just continue to escalate in these cities the further and further their team goes? Or are they selling these tickets to the same people, and at a certain point they just run out of money and the tickets won't sell for as much anymore?
Yeah, I don't think that the tickets are going to go unsold. The only way that might happen is, like you said, if you realize that, wait a second, this is not going to be an exciting game anymore. It's going to be a blowout, or, you know, I got better things to do, or something at the last minute came up that I can't go. But the further each of these Canadian teams go, the more the prices are going to go up. And to some extent, that's partly because none of them have been there recently. Of the four teams that are left, Vancouver has never won a Stanley Cup, although they've been a couple of times. Winnipeg has never even been, let alone won. Edmonton hasn't won in over 30 years, and the Leafs haven't won in almost 60 years. So,
you have any more great news that you could pass on to people, Moshe?
Well, you've got Dan coming on. He'll give you his attempt at probability calculations, but but that's just it. It's no one's seen a Stanley Cup. If you're under the age of 40, you haven't seen a parade here in Canada. So that type of thing then is probably going to drive these prices higher, that each step that they go, there's a chance that this could be the one, especially over in the West, where there's certainly the potential that of Edmonton, Vancouver, and Winnipeg, they could be having to compete with each other to see who gets to the Stanley Cup. That would be really exciting then for all of those fans.
And does this tell us the price of these tickets and the willingness of people to pay this price for these tickets, does that tell us anything about the economy, or does this tell us more about how much we love hockey in this country?
I think it's more a function of how much we love hockey, because the hangover effect is still to come, right? You've got to pay for those tickets. So
that's true.
Even when you put it on your credit card, you're going to see that. And, you know, that's when you have to go to that special someone and say, okay, so remember the game we went to? Well, that's your anniversary gift. Or you have to tell your kids that, sorry, there's no Christmas this year. We blew it on the hockey game. The disposable income is still finite. And so whether the economy is booming or whether it's flat, it's not like within the next 12 months you're going to be able to manufacture an extra $2,500 for a pair of tickets. And that's just the tickets. You still got to deal with transportation, food, and all of the other stuff that's built around it. It can easily run into thousands of dollars.
From Concordia University in Montreal, Moshe, thanks for your time tonight. Appreciate it.
Anytime.
It is Journal Corner, and our journalists of note tonight is Dan Barnes, sports feature writer with Post Media. And Dan, welcome to the program. One of the recent articles you wrote that caught our eye was titled "Canada's Stanley Cup Drought is a Mind-Boggling Mathematical Outlier." So we wanted to get you on. We wanted to put you on the spot. What did you find when you looked into this? What are the probabilities that we could go this long, since 1993, without having a Stanley Cup champion from this country?
Yeah, well, the probability was something like 0.00024 or something. I can't remember. There was a professor of mathematics and statistics at the U of A who worked it out using the Bernoulli counting principle. And I'm sure you're well aware of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Absolutely. You knew that. Right?
Practically wrote it myself.
Yeah, I imagine you did. So I am not a numbers guy, as you may have known. But yeah, infinitesimal, really, really small. And it makes no mathematical sense. It makes no anecdotal sense. But yes, it has been 29 straight Stanley Cup finals without a Canadian victory. And you wonder, is it something financial? And people have floated that Canadian teams can't get over the hump because they can't get the prize free agent every year because, you know, fill in the blanks. There's the weather's a thing, the expectations of Canadian fans. Some free agents don't want to deal with that kind of thing. But I just, you know, when you look at it, the talent level is clearly here in Edmonton. The talent level is there in Toronto. And they're the teams, you know, producing the all-stars and the award winners of late. And yet they still can't produce a Stanley Cup champion. This year may change it all. You know, who knows? The Oilers look pretty good in game one. And the Leafs are now even with Boston. So it could change at any time. But it is the weirdest thing because it's 29 straight Stanley Cup finals and they haven't won. So there was a response to the piece that I wrote. A gentleman suggested that we're worried about the wrong thing. It doesn't matter where the teams are, who's playing, right? How many Canadians are on each team? And maybe that's something you should be more concerned about because Canadian players obviously are on every team in the National Hockey League. So plenty of Canadian players win a Stanley Cup every year.
Yeah, but you're not going to have a Stanley Cup parade in downtown Toronto because, you know, St. Louis won with 18 Canadians on the roster.
This is true. It would be a pretty weird one to have.
It would be a little odd.
Yeah. But, yeah, I don't think there's any good explanation for why this has happened other than you take every single Stanley Cup final as its own individual event and you can break down, you know, the various things that that tipped the balance against, you know, the Calgary Flames back in whatever that was, 04 or whatever, 05, I can't even remember. And the Oilers in 06 and the Senators when they, you know, got all the way and the Canucks when they did it twice. So it is hard to explain that any geographical region, in fact, could go that long. And I broke that down too, you know, into the U.S. Northeast, the West, the South, the middle of their the United States, and each of those regions has produced at least four Stanley Cups in the last 29 years. So, you know, go figure.
But it would seem to make sense, like if you just went from strictly from the stats, there are this many Canadian teams, this many American teams, run the numbers, run the probabilities, and it comes up with an infinitesimally low probability that we would have gone this long since, what, 1993 without a Canadian team winning a Stanley Cup. But to your other point about competitive balance, like, yes, in Edmonton you've got Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl, you've got Marner and Matthews in Toronto, but that seems to be a more recent phenomenon, and maybe now those teams, because those players are there and because the teams on the backs of those players become more competitive, can draw more free agents or better players. But that hasn't always been the case for the last 30 years. I mean, there are some pretty dark years for all of these Canadian franchises when, you know, the discrepancy in the dollar and then just the fact that they just couldn't seem to attract those free agent players to come play for them.
This is true. And it was particularly bleak. I think it was around the early 2000s, late 1990s, when there were hardly any All-Stars, hardly any award winners on Canadian-based teams. But even so, the Oilers got to the final in 06. And they were, I mean, largely, I suppose you could look at Chris Pronger being at least partially responsible mm-hmm. for that. And he was a star, just ask him. and so, you know, yes, they weren't overflowing with the free agent talent every year. They were having trouble competing for those prize plums. But, and again, I think, yes, of late, that, you know, the McDavids and Draisaitls and Marners and Matthews and Nylanders, they have changed the ability of both Toronto and Edmonton to attract even more players in support roles, because let's face it, you can't keep paying everybody $12 million. So they are getting stronger, and perhaps this is the year that one or both of them get all the way to the Stanley Cup final and change the whole thing. But back in the day, yes, there were some lean years where Canadian teams couldn't produce anything to speak of in terms of talent, or at least, you know, top-level talent, the kind of talent that wins awards and gets on all-star teams. But it's strangely enough, at that point, those, you know, Canadian teams were getting to the final far more frequently than they have in the last 10 years. So I don't know. I don't get it.
Yeah, it is a bit of a head scratcher when you put it that way. And to the person who responded to your article about mentioning how many Canadians are on Stanley Cup winners over the years, that's one thing that is slowly changing as well, just in terms of the percentages. And there are some pretty competitive NHL teams now that have, not all of them, but some of them have a very light roster of Canadian talent.
Yeah, and that was just bound to happen, right? I mean, that is a product of having more and more Europeans all over the league, and of the American...
And Americans too, yeah.
Right? The United States hockey development system got way better in the last, whatever it was, 20 years, 25 years, pick a number. And so they were bound to produce better and better players all the time. So I don't think we should be amazed at all that the percentage of Canadians in the NHL, I'm assuming, has continued to drop. I haven't looked at the figures lately, but I'm assuming that's exactly what's happening, because there are more Europeans, top-level talent, making it into the NHL, and same goes for Americans.
And so, to put you on the spot, is this year that the drought ends? Do you foresee one of these Canadian teams currently competing in the first round making it not just to the final, but winning it all?
Well, I did not see that. In any of my hockey pools, I can tell you I did not see that. I figured there perhaps the Rangers and the Stars, or the Panthers and the Stars. But, you know, the Stars didn't look great in game one. The Oilers looked amazing in game one. But it's a long, long road. So, I don't foresee it, but my goodness, the Oilers could prove me wrong.
All right. And before we let you go, Dan, I did want to touch on your most recent article in the Post and Post Media about Harry Giroux and whether he might be the world's fastest man in his day. I honestly hadn't heard much about this until you kind of brought it back here in your article. But there's a school of thought that he actually was the first human ever to break the 10-second barrier in the 100 yards.
And indeed, there is that school of thought out there. It was 1960, late July 1960, in Saskatoon at Old Griffith Stadium. It was the Canadian Olympic trials that year, and Giroux won the final in a hand-timed time of... There were three stopwatches going, three official timers. Two of them had him at 10.0, and one had him at 10.1, in fact. But for whatever reason, the myth grew that the actual time was 9.9, that the timers got together immediately following the race. And again, for whatever reason, whether it's, you know, the fact that they thought nobody would believe they were correct, they allegedly rounded up from 9.9. Well, I couldn't find any evidence that that was the case. The official world record application form lists two times of 10.0 and one of 10.1, and the official time forwarded by them was 10.0, which was accepted by what was then the International Amateur Athletic Foundation, which is now World Athletics. So that the official time was 10.0, but there were people at that race who said that at the time, the word was that the timers got together and decided they had to round it up from 9.9, because the world record had just been set 24 days earlier by a German guy named Armin Harry. He ran 10.0 in Zurich, Switzerland, in late June. So I don't know exactly how the myth grew, but I believe it was a myth. I believe he probably ran 10.0, but, you know, it's hand timing. So the timers are at the finish line. They see a puff of smoke 100 meters away, and they have to hit their stopwatch immediately and then hit it again as Giroux crosses what was a very thin piece of tape, I guess, at the finish line, and his chest has to hit that, and they hit the stopwatch not with their thumb, because your thumb's too fat for that, Sid. You have to use your index.
You're talking specifically about mine?
Well, no, I haven't seen your thumb in ages. I have no idea. But you got to use your index finger, because it's less fat, and so it takes less time to get through the button. Anyway, it's, you know what? It was the means of the day. That's how it was done for years and years and years. And it was accepted, right, that all those records were bona fide. And so there you are. He was in the books at 10.0 hand-timed, which World Athletics equates to 10.24. They add 0.24 to any race under 300 meters long.
Yeah, and so, but it is interesting because, you know, we kind of, it's hard to imagine now timing an Olympic 100-meter race with just a stopwatch, but that was the means for decades and decades. So the person who had set the previous record would have been timed in the same manner, but you were able to find, I know you feel that that it is just a myth, but you were able to find in your article people that say, no, this was, he ran 9.9.
Oh, yeah, there was several people. Bruce Kidd, one of Canada's great distance runners, was among them. He was watching the race right there at the finish line. George Short, who was in the race and finished third, I believe, he was of the opinion that Jerome had, in fact, run 9.9. He himself was clocked in at 10.5, and he was well up the track from Harry, I can tell you that much. I've seen the CBC video of it. But yeah, that apparently was the common wisdom of the day for whatever reason. And you know how these things can start, right? I mean, somebody said, oh, yeah, for sure he was 9.9. They just had to round up because nobody believed this could happen in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. So there was some of that going on. And Bruce Kidd watched the race at the finish line with Hal Brown, who was then the Olympic track and field team coach. And Bruce Kidd swears that Hal Brown timed him at 9.9. So that's what he was going on, and perhaps it grows out of that. I don't know. Maybe there was a bunch of stopwatches, not the official ones, but other stopwatches that all had him at 9.9, and that could have been where it started.
You think there'd be a way now that somebody could go back and time it using the footage, no?
Well, that, you know what? I thought that very thing. So I contacted Omega, the official timer of the Olympics, and sent them the CBC Saskatchewan clip, and they said they simply couldn't do it reliably. They couldn't get a definitive time out of it because they had concerns about whether the footage over time has been sped up. And so there was all kinds of reasons that they laid out for me that they would not be able to do it to their satisfaction, and therefore they weren't even going to give it a shot because it's just unreliable video information.
Well, it's interesting to think about for sure. And even a 10.0 for that day was obviously incredibly, incredibly fast. Dan, thanks for your time this evening. We do appreciate it.
Great to speak to you, Sid. Cheers.
It is unfortunately already forest fire season in this country, particularly in Western Canada, but that doesn't mean that other parts of the country are going to be immune from this. And if we think back to last year, we all know what a devastating year it was for forest fires. And we were kind of warned that, you know, given the mild winter over much of the country, given the lower than average snowpack over much of the country, that we could be in this very situation that we find ourselves in now. But to help us kind of digest this and maybe kind of wrap our head around what we could be in store for this summer, Robert Gray joins us. Robert is a wildland fire ecologist and president of RW Gray Consulting. Robert, thanks for coming on the show tonight.
You're very welcome.
Should we have been expecting this?
Yes, we should. And the reality is this can happen any year. You know, whether we've had a pre-existing condition from last year and we drought, what's happening climatically is that we can go from seemingly normal conditions and they can flip almost on a dime to situations where things have dried out very quickly and fuels are available. So, you know, we've sort of looked in the past at heavy snowpack and thinking that that was going to delay fire seasons. But what we've seen is that snowpacks are coming off very, very quickly in the springtime. So, you know, anything that we thought in was sort of normal in the past that had an impact on fire seasons, it's all open for discussion now. It's all an open field.
I'm interested in that very point because I was talking to someone not long ago and we were kind of, you know, just shooting the breeze, but both kind of were saying that it seems that we've gone from, you know, having a winter, a spring, and a summer to basically a winter and a summer. So even in those years where you do have a significant snowpack, you get the temperatures in the spring warm up so quickly that, you know, a melt that used to take, you know, 5 or 6 weeks now might take a week and a half or 2 weeks.
Exactly. That's exactly what we're seeing. And it's very observant of your colleague to see that, because, you know, we're seeing the snowpacks are coming off very quickly, regardless of whether it was above normal or not. And it is becoming kind of a winter and summer situation. When we look long term at how fire seasons are growing, it's the spring and the fall. So and some of the models are suggesting that spring fire seasons are going to see, you know, quicker lengthening than fall fire seasons. So what may have been, you know, a period of fire danger of 20 days in the past is likely already at 30 days, and within another couple decades could be at 40 days. So, yeah, the situation is getting worse over time.
And as we can you just bring us up to date a little bit? And I know these are obviously evolving situations when we're talking about fires. And I think it was in Alberta, there were some evacuation alerts and some of those mm-hmm. have been lifted now. British Columbia has a number of fires. I think it was somewhere over 100. And I know that doesn't mean that all of them are huge and all of them are out of control. But what are some of those Western provinces dealing with right now?
They're dealing with increased fire behavior early in the season. And what that does is it, you know, it starts to use up resources. Something that we have to be aware of going into this fire season nationally is that, you know, a lot of people had a very long fire season last year from the provincial firefighting agencies and even our contractors too. And they never really had a chance to recover over the winter. I know crews that were, you know, basically they saw 130 days of deployment. That's an extremely long fire season. It takes a toll on you. So we're seeing early fire behavior now, not unprecedented. You know, the boreal in the north, you know, tends to dry out quickly. We start to see fires in April, May, and the big fires in the boreal have typically been kind of in May. But another really important factor here is that the people that we rely on to, you know, basically tackle those fires, they're still exhausted from last year. And that's, we have to be really careful as this fire season progresses, that we're aware of that.
And we continue our conversation with Robert Gray, wildland fire ecologist, about the forest fire season, which unfortunately in some parts of the country is already underway, and we're only at April 24th. Robert, before the break, you mentioned something that I was wondering about and I find quite interesting. You know, we know that we need to prepare for earlier starts to the forest fire season, but when we're coming out of a year like we had last year, where there's just these massive fires seemingly all across the country, you're saying that some of these resources are still exhausted from that.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they put in, you know, extremely long hours, long deployments, multiple deployments. You know, they go back to the same fire 2 and 3 times. They're working in really hazardous, stressful, smoke-filled conditions throughout the day. Often the fire camp isn't that far away from the fire, so they could be, you know, in the smoke, not sleeping well overnight. So it takes a really significant toll on your body and your emotional state. You know, we're seeing globally amongst, you know, wildland firefighters, increases in anxiety and depression. Suicides are going up. There's issues around, you know, cardiopulmonary disease because of what they're exposed to and cancer. So, I mean, they're a very precious resource, and we've put a lot of importance on what they do, and we need to recognize the sacrifices that they're making. We need to have a different approach to how we tackle these kind of fire seasons. And I know some of the recommendations around, you know, we're gonna bring on nationally another 1,000 firefighters. That's not really what we need to do.
What do we need to do?
So just bringing more firefighters to tackle things in a response and recovery mode, we're still reacting to fire. We're, you know, fire is still setting the tempo. You know, we're reacting to it. And just suppressing more fire, it's the fire paradox. The more we suppress fire, the worse eventual fires become. So we need a workforce which is more regionally focused, local people who are engaged, you know, prior to the fire season, doing that necessary fuels work. I mean, right now here in southeastern BC, between the local communities and BC Wildfire Service, they pulled off 3 prescribed burns yesterday. That's fantastic. We need to do so much more of that. Do the fuels work. There's the local knowledge about where water is, where the resources are. You understand the lay of the land. Fire season breaks out. You've got more people who can be put on the fire line to tackle fires. And then once the fire season's over, they're either rehabbing the fires or they're going back to do that necessary fuels work. The more fuels work we do, the less fires, you know, become severe, the less problematic they become, and we're putting people in less danger. So we have to move to more of an upfront mitigation and prevention mode where we're doing the necessary fuels work. We'll have more capacity for the fire season, and we're putting less effort into just responding to fires. That's the approach we need to take. It's tougher. It's more complex. It's a long-term approach. It doesn't always fit within a four-year election cycle. It's more costly, but it's better than having these runaway fires and high costs and putting people in risk, in danger.
Is it more difficult to do prescribed burns now with the forest conditions than they would have been if we'd been doing it all along?
Well, certainly under indigenous stewardship, you know, prior to European contact, they did so much burning. They would call it cultural burning because of the objectives that they're focused on. And they did so much of it that we didn't have 50,000, 100,000 hectare fires. Fires were small. All the research that we've done shows that, you know, average fire size pre-contact was quite small because so much of the land was converted to different vegetation types and structures. It just didn't burn like our wall-to-wall conifer forests do. So we have to move back toward that pattern across the landscape. Yes, prescribed burning is more difficult now because of fuels. We're having some issues because of climate change and narrower windows, but we're going at it very proactively and very carefully, and the burns we're doing, we're meeting our objectives. We just have a capacity problem now. We don't have enough people who are trained to do it, and that's what we're focusing our efforts on now. So more consistent funding, tackling some of the policy barriers, and getting more resources in hand, because this is part of our solution for the future. It's a key part of it.
And are all jurisdictions on board with this? So if we say, okay, obviously, if there's going to be more fires and bigger fires, we need more people to fight them, and that's the manpower aspect of it that you touched on. But then when it comes to the preventative measures, are jurisdictions on board with that? Are we behind on that? Where are we with that?
We're way behind in Canada. So the U.S. Conducts about 150,000 prescribed burns a year on about 10 million acres, so about 4 million hectares. And it's across the board. In the Southeast, they do a lot of burning, but almost every state, they're actively doing burning. And sometimes it's ranchers, sometimes it's, you know, it's federal or state agencies, sometimes it's tribes. They're all in. It's an all hands, all lands approach they're taking. In Canada, we're lagging way behind. I know there's interest in a lot of different jurisdictions, but some of the provincial ministries just aren't there yet. Alberta is ramping up. Parks Canada has been a big leader. BC is really embracing this with the cultural and prescribed fire program and working big on it. Yukon is thinking on it too, but we are decades behind the U.S. and we need to catch up, but we have to do it very carefully and proactively.
Did it take a year like we had last year to really make this a front burner issue and to get politicians moving on it?
You know, we discussed it. You know, we had several prior, you know, bad fire seasons, and we had, you know, sort of government commission report, and it recommended doing more prescribed burning. I was part of one back in 2004 after the 2000 fire season. We recommended more prescribed burning. Nothing happened for 20 years. We had bad fire season in 2017, 2018. We had another flood and fire report that was done. 9 recommendations out of 100 were prescribed fire and cultural fire. Nothing really happened. Finally, you know, the dam burst just a couple of years ago. We got the right people in government, in BC Wildfire Service, and they really started to push a mandate. It was resourced up, which is great. There's more people involved in it. So something happened, 2021 maybe. It's definitely on the radar. There's lots of push now. We're talking about possibly prescribed fire training academy at the UBC Okanagan campus. We're moving ahead. Other provinces, we don't know a lot of details about it there, but you know, kind of BC and Alberta are kind of leading the way in Canada. And we have a long way to go.
And you would think that given our geography, that Canadians would want to be on the leading edge of this and not looking at other countries and saying, well, they seem to be maybe doing a better job than we are.
Definitely. You know, there's certainly some national pride to be gained from this. And it just has so many benefits. I mean, we know the benefit of this. We've done a lot of research on looking at treatment effectiveness when it comes to managing wildfire. Thinning and prescribed fire, landscape scale prescribed fire, it works. It has the greatest impact. We conducted a prescribed burn last spring in conjunction with the local indigenous group, Occam community. And then a wildfire hit it, and that prescribed burn was so strategically placed it saved the airport, which was also the tanker base, and the refueling site for the helicopters, and saved about another 100 homes. So we know the value of it, and we just have to be doing so much more of it.
And so given all of what you know and all that you've been involved in, would you say, like, right now, are you optimistic or pessimistic about where we're headed in the next, you know, 1 to 5 years when it comes to preventing fires?
I'm optimistic in some of these, you know, strategic initiatives, certainly the cultural and prescribed fire side. And I'm speaking specifically about BC because I know it best. Mm-hmm. I'm not as optimistic when it comes to the larger policy funding side of things. I mean, the provincial budget recently came out, and there was a paltry amount of money for fuels work, for getting out ahead of fires and tackling things in that mitigation prevention mode. Just tiny amounts of money. And yet, you know, the province set aside $10 billion over 3 years for contingency. Well, that's basically $10 billion, once again, to react to fires, as opposed to investing heavily up front to mitigate fires so that you're not having to spend so much money down the road. That's money that could go to healthcare and housing and all those things. And we're setting it aside because we can't get ahead of the problem. And that's the wrong approach. We have to somehow develop the political will to spend the kind of money necessary to save the money down the road.
And unfortunately, you know, when I'm listening to you, you could be talking about almost any issue when it comes to you know, we blame the politicians, but we talk about politics, but just whatever it is in society, it seems that we're much more willing to, you know, to jump into action when something has occurred rather than put the thought and the resources into trying to prevent them from occurring in the first place, whether that's healthcare or accident prevention or you name it, you know, and in this case, fires.
Yeah, it's certainly a concerning pattern. The issue with this one is that, and I'm not being, you know, this isn't hyperbole, but wildfire, if we don't tackle this, it has the very real potential to bankrupt the province. I mean, you know, we spent $1 billion last year just on suppression. So that's just attacking the fires. There was probably $10 to $15 billion in indirect and additional costs associated with the fires. The U.S. pegs that theirs at $74 to $350 billion a year in economic burden of wildfires. We don't have that kind of economy that they have in the States. I mean, we're a province of 5 million people. If we continue to have these billion-dollar fire seasons, it'll be death by a thousand cuts, and we will bankrupt the province. You know, this isn't Chicken Little. This is real. Mm-hmm. So we have to get out ahead of this. Otherwise, we'll see complete loss of the timber industry. We'll see significant impacts to watersheds and water quality. And these are all going to just raise the cost of this thing. And like I said, that contingency, we're going to have to set aside more and more money year after year to react to things if we don't get out in front of them.
Yeah, and you can just picture people listening. I know you're talking specifically in some cases about British Columbia, but people listening in Alberta and Manitoba and Ontario and just thinking, you know, the same issues are happening right across this country. Robert, thanks for joining us. You know, it is unfortunate that we're in this situation right now and forest fires already breaking out in mid-April, but it was in some ways predictable. And now how do we fight them when they start? But even as important, and maybe more importantly to your point, is how are we going to mitigate those chances of the fires cropping up like this in the future? Thanks for your time today.
You're very welcome. Have a good night.
The song is Hideaway. The artist is Kaiza, who joins us now here on A Little More Conversation. The new album, welcome to the program, first of all, Kaiza. The new album, Dancing and Crying, arrives on May 24th. We've got a lot of ground to cover here, but I will start with the new album. You've called this your most deeply personal and meaningful project to date. That's saying something with where you've been on your musical journey. Why is that?
Well, it came out of a very long healing process from the car crash that was in 2017. And this whole process of healing allowed me to connect with myself in a much deeper way and accept things about myself that I may have been sort of hiding away, tucking away in the shadows. And I, being so, you know, successful in my lane, I was very much staying in my lane and not actually opening a lot of myself up or showing my audience all these other sides of myself that were actually a more complete picture of myself as an artist, like the singer, songwriter, and folk singer. You got a little bit of those. Like I sing a cover of Take Me to Church and I, you know, bring out the guitar one or two songs on stage and sing What Is Love. But some of my greatest songs are actually, you know, just sitting in a Dropbox or in my voice memos on the guitar. So I just realized having nearly, you know, potentially lost my life, I wanted to make sure that everything I put into the world had a very whole expression. So I decided to try to merge those two sides of myself to create a more whole picture of who I am as an artist. And you're going to now see this coming up in the next three songs.
And I I do want to get into maybe your beginnings as well and have you walk us through that evolution, because I think for those who've come to your music more recently, they might be surprised about a folk background and the guitar playing and the more maybe stripped down version. But you did reference the car accident from 2017. So for those who aren't familiar, can you, first of all, how are you doing? And can you kind of maybe explain to people exactly what you went through? Because this was not an easy process, was it?
Honestly, it's a bit of a miracle that I am sitting here with you right now and that my career is relaunching and thriving again, because I really did not see it ever happening. I was T-boned. I wasn't driving. I was in an Uber in the back seat. And we were T-boned and I sustained a brain injury, traumatic brain injury. And it made me, I'd say, bedridden 50% of the time. But in pain 100% of the time, to a point where I wasn't able to work, or I had very small windows where I was able to work. It completely pulled the rug out from my life, my career, everything. And I tried really hard to get out of bed, and despite my body needing to heal, tried to keep the momentum going that I had built, because I was just about, literally I was just breaking as a headline act on festivals and getting the main stages. And, you know, it was like stepping into new territory, having worked so hard with this song going so big. And then suddenly it all just, you know, destroyed by this split second moment that I couldn't see coming. And I was really in denial for so long, and I didn't want to just let go of everything, but ultimately I had to let go of everything, including the identity I had with myself. And I had to identify now as a sick person healing and allow everything that I had built to just sort of crumble away while I kind of surrendered to the unknown. And that's when I started healing. And so about 2 years into that, I, let's see, 2018, 2019, I started working on the next album, Crave. And I was so sad and so hurt from everything. I just didn't want to put out any like dark music. So Crave, you can hear, is very upbeat, positive. And it was perfect timing because the pandemic hit and I had this really positive album that I was happy because the world was in such a dark place that I was able to put something so positive out into the world. But I, you know, the first album was written with very little time because Hideaway blew up and I only had about three songs written already. So I had to go write the rest in a matter of like a month or so because I was constantly traveling at the time. I had very little time to actually create. The second album, I compiled songs that I had written but hadn't actually necessarily thought of for my album, because had it not happened and had the crash not happened, I probably would have continued on with a very similar trajectory. So this third album is the first album I've ever had that I've had time to write, which usually that's the first album for artists. They say like, right, artists' first albums are their best because they had, you know, their whole life to write it.
Yeah, exactly. Authors the same way. The first book is the best because they've been working on it their entire life, and then the publisher expects another one in 18 months.
Exactly. So it's funny because it's all reversed for me. Like, I feel like I've really been able to take the time with this one, and I actually waited a year to put it out because I didn't know what I wanted to do with the visuals. And then in that time that I waited, I actually wrote the song "The Mysterious Disappearance of At a Place" that came out, that's coming out this week. So I'm very thankful I waited, but also it gave me time to actually kind of make a decision to go bigger than I wanted, but also remain indie.
Is there more frustration? And I don't know what it was like for you, that process of recovering from a traumatic brain injury where physicians or rehab specialists maybe can't put a finite date or timeline on recovery where they could with a muscle injury or a bone break, with a brain, there's just so much that's unknown in terms of what the future is going to look like.
Honestly, I was shocked that even the most advanced neuroscientists in the world still know very little when it comes to like surgery and attaching things and that kind of stuff structurally. I'd say that's where the people have the most knowledge. But when it comes to understanding what happens in an injury, honestly, it's like exploring outer space. And it really is, because there's more neural connections in our brain than visible stars in the galaxy in the sky that we look at. So it is like exploring outer space, and all of it's on a microscopic, or a lot of it's on a microscopic level that we just can't see. I was very frustrated because I realized that there's not much that people have to offer when it comes to like MRIs and things like that. My head injury was is microscopic damage, so it didn't show up in an MRI. But you know what? It did show up in an electrical neural feedback. When they scan the electrical currents of your brain, we could see the injury very clearly, and just see that the way that my brain was disconnected from other, like certain sections were not communicating properly for a long time. So I did a lot of therapy with neural feedback, and that definitely helped, because I wouldn't fall asleep at all. I couldn't fall asleep, and that really helped me get sleeping again, which, as we all know, sleep is the most important thing in life.
I love your write-up on Spotify. I just want to read a little bit. It says, "I'm weird and I sing a bit. I'm a closet scientist when in hermit mode, and I make surrealist art to process the constant BS that life throws my way. I'm equally as social as I am antisocial. My life is very feather-like, and I embrace that." What do you mean when you say your life is very feather-like?
That's actually the feather is one of the sort of metaphors that I use for life, because the only way that I could get through to the next day was to just fully surrender to, I don't know, the unknown, and just blow in the wind like a feather. I think of that feather in Forrest Gump.
Mm-hmm.
That's just at the very beginning, just kind of floating and lands on his lap. I had no control over the outcome of my injury, and I had no idea if I'd ever be back on stage dancing again, because for the first few years I couldn't dance. I couldn't go to the gym. I couldn't work out. I can barely read. I had to rehabilitate my reading. So I just didn't foresee myself necessarily ever getting fully recovered, because I also knew that brain damage can be permanent. People say live in the present, right? Well, my present was so horrible that I had to leave the present to get through a day.
Right.
I had to live in my hope and my imagination and sort of meditate on how I wanted to feel more than anything, because I was in so much pain. I just would meditate on the feeling of no pain and the feeling of joy. And really there was no image to go with that. It was just the feeling I wanted to find again.
And sorry, and maybe describing your life that way as feather-like and sort of going with the current will already answer my next question. But I was always curious when you've talked about your earliest beginnings and, you know, a guitar and almost a folky kind of sound to where you are now. Was that just a process of going with the flow? Was there ever any decision made that this is where I want to take my career and this is the sort of genres that I want to explore next?
You know, it's funny because the beginning of my musical career, I had no intention of doing it as a career. It was simply a passion. and I loved singing my songs for people. And I was very strange. Like I was shy in my own way, but then I had no problem walking up to a complete stranger with a guitar and asking if they wanted a song. So when it came to sharing music, I had no fear. I think I had fear in other aspects of my life. Like if I had a crush on somebody, I'd get really nervous. Like I had none of that with music. So I would just strap my guitar on. I'd go walking around. I'd like walk into law buildings and ask if the lawyers wanted a performance.
That's wonderful. Honestly, that's a great approach to life.
It's amazing how like that was some of the most, those are some of the coolest people I met because they were so happy that I just walked in and sang to them that they're like, I walked into a website building and they're like, we'll build your website for you. But I didn't have any intention. I didn't even know what building I was walking into. I was just like, hey, you guys want a song? I have a song. So I just liked playing for people and I did it so much that I feel very comfortable as a performer and having lost that side of myself in the car crash. That was a big loss to me. It was literally like losing myself. But so when I became really successful, like I got into college by accident. All the things that happen by accident are the things that seem to go right for me. So someone had sent my demo CD to college without informing me, and I got accepted without applying to Selkirk College.
A lot less nerve-wracking that way.
Yeah, I was like, this is a sign, I should go. And then when I was in my first semester of Selkirk College, I applied for Berklee College of Music and I ended up getting a full scholarship to Berklee. And so I was like, well, that's a sign too. I guess I should go to Berklee. And then I ended up going to Berklee, which is in Boston, and studied music there. And then I ended up, well, I was like, you know, they say if you make it in New York, you'll make it anywhere. So I was like, well, I'm not that far from New York. So I'd start taking these buses on the weekends and even skip class some days to go hustle in New York. And that's kind of where it all started spiraling for me. And I realized that I could have a career as a songwriter and started meeting people. And it was very tough. Like it was not open doors. People were not just like, come on in. Like I really had to show up and ask and beg. Eventually I met the producer that ended up making Hideaway, and I started getting into songwriting camps for labels, and I ended up getting a publishing deal. So once it started kind of becoming a career, people would be like, I need a song that sounds like this for this artist. So I started focusing on specifically writing certain sounds. And I think that's when my mindset got a little more controlling over the creative process, because I would study an artist and I'd try to sound like them. So I'd make a good demo CD in them, or a demo track for them. And then when it came to Hideaway, it was sort of not planning on writing that for myself. I just wrote it with Rami, the producer. And we're kind of both like, this sounds really good. Like maybe we should just keep this one.
So I'm always curious about the writing process. So when you have written songs for Kylie Minogue and Rihanna, I don't think they've been released yet, but was that part of that process where were you consciously writing for that artist, or did you write something and then say, I think this would sound great if they performed it?
You know what's really interesting is, so Kylie Minogue's the reason I got my first publishing deal, because she recorded my song Slow Motion Fighting, which I now put out, but she never ended up releasing it. It was a different version, which I honestly didn't like it as much, but the fact that Kylie Minogue cut my song made like six publishing companies interested in me as a writer, and that's how it led to my writing, my publishing contract. And then Rihanna put a bunch of my songs on hold, but she always put songs, like she put my folk songs on hold, which is so strange. Like I never, ever, ever would have guessed she would have put, she recorded like that one song. I really do wish she put it out. It's so, so wonderful, but very, very, very different for her. A lot of these bigger artists, they'll have hundreds of songs on hold. Beyonce holds a lot of tracks, and when your track's on hold, it's not being pitched to other artists who could sing it. So kind of you sometimes miss a window, and if you've written in a specific sound that's sort of a time, you miss that window too, and then you get to reproduce it. So it's a whole game.
I do want to ask you one more before we let you go here. In addition to the new album Dancing and Crying, which comes out on the 24th of May, you have a performance. It's a few months away. It's coming up in October, but you're going to be performing with the Calgary Philharmonic. How Are you anticipating that? That seems to me like that might be a little nerve-wracking, but maybe it's not for you. Maybe it's simply exhilarating.
I'd say exhilarating is the right word. I've always had an orchestra on my bucket list. And you know, it was so wild because ever since I decided to become a feather and go like a feather, life has just kind of presented opportunities just out of the blue without me planning it. But in this case, I had this vision of myself come really intensely and that I was playing with an orchestra. And so I texted my manager. I was like, I really want to do a dance symphony one day. And I have this whole vision for it. And without us even submitting or going to look for an orchestra, the very next day, I got this pitch from the Calgary Philharmonic Orchestra that they wanted to work with me. So it was weird manifestation.
Meant to be, meant to be.
And it's kind of amazing that it's in my hometown. Like it's going back to where everything began for me and starting this yet another chapter. So I'm literally just thrilled for it. I'm overwhelmed because right now I'm just working on rolling out the album and all the music videos and the radio theater productions that go with them. Because Dancing and Crying, I do all the editing myself on all the music videos and all the radio plays. I don't know if you've heard the radio plays, but I highly suggest you go down that rabbit hole. It's a whole story. It's a lot more work than I had anticipated for myself, but it's very joyful work, but we're kind of in crunch time now. So the moment that like May 23rd rolls through and everything's out, I'm going to be like, I'm going to have this deep breath of like, okay, what else am I working on? So simultaneously, we're like in calls with the orchestra and the orchestrators. And so it is in progress. It's just,
well, you will have earned a deep breath, even if it's only momentary. Kaiza, thank you so much for joining us. Great to talk with someone who's so passionate about what they do and why they do it. Best of luck with the new album, and best of luck with everything you do in your future, including that performance with the Philharmonic in Calgary. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Take care.